The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening. And for those of you in the outer hall, if you want to come inside here, you're kind of far away. There are chairs in here, quite a few actually, so you're welcome to come forward if you'd like. So good evening again. And when I was thinking about coming down here for this evening, I had a stronger feeling, stronger desire to hear from you than to hear from myself. And so I'd rather not give a talk tonight, but I'd rather see if there's any topics that are on your minds, any questions you might have. See what resides with you. It's a large group of people, and I don't want to guess what you're interested in, what's important for you. So I wonder if, anyway, that's what we have in store tonight. And so if some of you have some questions or topics or something of interest, great to speak up. You're ready.
So, I heard meditation was supposed to be peaceful. I heard meditation was supposed to be peaceful. Well, you know, this idea of coming to some kind of peace through meditation. But first of all, the idea of just sitting with my mind without doing anything, you know, doesn't sound like it would be peaceful. And then when I actually do it, it's, you know, quite challenging. So I wonder if you could speak to that.
Yes. It can be that way. I hope it's valuable to sit with. I hope it's still valuable to sit with an agitated mind.
How so?
How so? I think that more important than getting calm is to be true, to really to see what's really happening. And it's not so common for people to really stop and really see and recognize clearly what's going on with them themselves. And so If we're not peaceful, you can bypass yourself. You can kind of divert around yourself and not really get to know yourself by doing things like calming yourself down or by getting inspired by a great Dharma talk, all kinds of things. And but what's really important, I think in the big picture of things, it's much more important to really know yourself really well and know who you are and how you tick and really how it is. I had a teacher, Buddhist teacher, who started meditating back in the 60s. I think he was in college. And he was introduced to Zen. And so the first period of Zazen, Zen meditation, you're told to sit in a very particular way, cross-legged, sit very straight for 45 minutes and not move. And, you know, if someone's never meditated before, that's quite difficult. And he found it, he was an athlete as well, so I think his muscles were kind of muscle-bound, and his legs especially. And he found that it was very painful for him, excruciating painful. And but as he went home from that meditation, he felt, for the first time, he felt real. He felt he'd never been real with himself before, never been real with life. And that meeting with himself, he felt real and felt something, in touch with something that he had never been in touch with before. And so he came back and eventually became a Zen teacher. So I'm not saying you should sit with pain and difficulty like him, But I think it's more important to meditate as a way of meeting yourself and being honest what's here, and then see what happens through that honesty, than it is to become. So get to know your agitation. So, Analoy, can you pass the mic out to Analoy? Oh, you have one. Okay, you have it. I don't know. I don't think so. Green light. But my volume.
There we go. Okay. My question is about how to deal with debilitating fear, and I have some painful changes coming up, and a lot I need to do about it. And there is this debilitating fear, and I'm getting ready to go through a lot of your talks on Audio Dharma about fear, and I sit with it and I breathe into it, and it's not working very well for me right now.
Okay, great. Thank you. It's a great question, and that kind of question is something you ask for many people. Many people in our world sit with fear. It's a huge issue. But before I answer it, I saw a jacket going on. Is it getting too cold in here, or should we? You okay with the air conditioner on? And then the other is my volume of loud enough. Should we increase it a little bit up? No, out there it's perfect, but some people in here, a little bit higher. Okay. So hopefully, so there's many ways of discussing your fear. And the first thing that occurred to me is to keep going the theme in which I responded to the first question, which is one of the important aspects of this practice is to not deal with the fear, but to meet the fear and get to know it. And so one of the things I'm hoping that people who learn how to meditate do is they, in the meditation or through the mindfulness practice, learn the ability to sit with it in a very honest way. Not run away from it, not get anxious, not get worried about being afraid, and not become a, some people like me, I have an ostrich personality. If it's too challenging, like with my head down to the sand, or some people run away, some people get angry. So to not to give in to those kind of secondary things and just really sit with it and meet the fear. It's a powerful thing to do. And one of the things you learn by doing that is to be stronger than your fear. But you don't get stronger from your fear by dealing with it and finding solutions and going to therapy and all kinds of meditating, trying to, as a solution, making it go away. There's something very powerful about confronting it and just being with it. So I could have answered that way. That occurred to me. But I had it, and then I thought, it's maybe another way of answering the question. And that is, at this point, at this day, this moment in the world, there are many people who are having to deal with the fear of change, some horrendous change in their community and society. And now you're going through a very common human experience. If you think of it as a common human experience that you share with other people, does it shift your relationship to it at all?
I have done that a little bit, and I'll do it more. I could right now. I'm feeling lonely with that fear, as if everybody around me has it all together, which of course is ridiculous.
Oh well, let's see here. How many people in this room feel like you've had significant fear this week?
Oh, good.
So you're not so lonely anymore.
Okay, thank you. Just... No, but it is important that I am trying to deal with it, trying to get over it, blah, blah, blah. And so just being as simple and pure with it and not try to do anything about it necessarily.
It's a good beginning. It's a good partial strategy. Many people never do that. They run around. They run away. They're too quickly going to solutions. And then we don't really learn about what's really going on in a deep way. There's nothing but stopping and really taking a look. We will learn something that we often don't see. And we also develop our character, our strength, the ability to sit there and not run around and not try to fix. But we want the fear to go away, for sure. I don't want you to just be another person who just learns how to tolerate fear, just sits with it. And so there is a time and place for trying to work with it psychologically. Sometimes it's important to work with it socially. Sometimes the world needs to change. Knowing how to work with it is an important part of it. But as I said in the beginning, there's many ways, many things I could have said, and these are the two things that occurred to me today to you. So hopefully they're relevant, and you found out you're not alone.
Thank you. Actually, I feel the ball in my chest loosening a little bit.
Oh.
So thank you.
Great. That's nice. Thank you. So someone else. Yes, please.
Kind of on the same theme as a mind that's constantly agitated when you're meditating or feeling fear once again. And wanting to solve it desperately. Sometimes, you know, work, people do things that I could say, why are we doing that? That's not productive. And I find myself getting quite irritated. And so my meditation is often filled with irritation and quite frankly, hostility. And it's so easy to dump on myself. After all these years of meditating, you know, why can't I get a hold of my anger and really deal with it? And so instead, to sit with it, feel where I'm feeling it in my body. So it was helpful for you to hear you just say right now that, yes, eventually we do want something to change, but I guess not to be a knee-jerk reaction to just try and solve it right away. Because it's not a mistake. The feeling is not a mistake. That's what's happening. Yeah. And that's so very hard for me to accept.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I don't think when we sit down to meditate, it's not helpful to think that what's happening, what you're feeling going on inside of you, is wrong. This is like the one time I think it's like a sanctuary, sacred sanctuary. Sit down this way, and whatever you're feeling, whatever you're thinking, whatever's happening, there's space for it. It's allowed for it. Because then it allows for the honesty that I'm talking about. You want to be really honest and make space and learn. And this is a safe place to do that when your eyes are closed. Just, you know, even if you're angry at your boss and you want to punch him out, there's space for that anger and meditate because at least while you're meditating, you're not going to. And so you get to see what's going on and discover what's going on and learn patience, learn not to give in to these impulses. A lot of things you can learn. One of the important things when we are spending time in meditation, thinking about something, constantly going back, you know, over the loop, is to make the distinction between giving in to the thought versus stepping away from the thought train and watching it. So are you living in, like, you're getting on the train of thoughts and fueling it with a coal into the, you know, locomotive and really, you know, thinking it even better, or are you able to step off the train and watch it and not feed it anymore? And that's the huge distinction. So we're not against anything, we're allowing it to be there, but we're also not feeding it.
And then also to learn for myself, what does it feel like to not react here and just sense it?
Yes.
And just experience it?
Yes. And what does it feel like for you?
I like the feeling that I'm stepping back and observing it, that there's spaciousness when I'm feeling in a very peaceful state. Those things happen too, right? To just really be connected with my breath and to watch and observe, that's such beautiful spaciousness. It's such a nice place to go to. Well, when I'm feeling agitated or angry, that spaciousness is more difficult to achieve, especially if I'm trying to solve the problem.
Right.
But if I'm not trying to solve the problem, it's easier for me to hook into that kind of feeling of ah.
Yeah, so that's one of the. So if you're solving the problem in meditation, then you're on the train,
right?
The thought trains,
right? Right.
And so it's a counterintuitive for many people to think that they're not supposed to be solving the problem, because that's what human minds are often built to do: is to figure out the problem and to solve it. And it's often driven by fear. It's often driven by anger. Driven by all kinds of things. We have to do this, and it has to be now. And so to learn that to not be on the train and watch it allows something very different to happen. It allows us to understand it more deeply. It allows a spaciousness. It allows more wisdom to come in. And it trains us. It develops, again, our character, our minds, so that we're not on automatic pilot. And there will come a time in our life, maybe of some great crisis, where the best thing we can do in the situation is to stand tall and confident and not react. Because to react out of the habit just makes it worse. Okay? Great, thank you. Someone else? Yes, here. Maybe in the corner there, Helen.
So, what's been on my mind lately has been a lot of sadness because of the deaths of the Irish students in Berkeley.
Death of?
The Irish J-1
students. Oh yes, you're from Ireland. And we had, how many students died?
Six.
Six of them.
Well, they fell five off. And one Irish-American.
Oh yeah, so
she was a cousin.
She was a cousin of yours?
She was a cousin of an Irish student who was visiting.
Uh-huh. I can't hear. I don't understand a word.
Oh, you can't hear what you're saying. She said what's on her mind is sadness because of the death of six Irish students in Berkeley. And then you're saying that you know some of them or the relatives of them?
No, two who died were cousins. Cousins of each other.
Oh, cousins of each other.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then that was followed a few days later by the massacre in Charleston. And then a few days ago, the massacre on the beach at Sousse, Tunisia. Mm-hmm. I've just felt a lot of sadness. So you're going to hear a lot of major themes this evening, I don't know, the next 25 minutes.
Yeah. So I think it's a completely appropriate to feel sadness. I mean, I think it's sometimes it's appropriate to have our hearts broken. And in fact, that's one of the consequences. If you meditate, if you're a mindfulness person, we're more likely to have our hearts broken. Because we're more open, present, we see, we're better witness for what happens, and we're present in a bigger way. And it's not a mistake to have our hearts broken.
You said a very lovely and very interesting quote yesterday in the talk about the... Was it the Cambodian monk who set up temples, and he chanted hate is not...
Never overcome by hate. Hate is only overcome by love.
Mm.
Yeah, the story I said yesterday was that Mahagosananda was one of the few monks, about 3,000 out of 60,000, who survived the genocide in Cambodia, of monks. And he survived because he was in Thailand. But he went to go to the Cambodian refugee camps, apparently at the threat of his life. Pol Pot didn't really want him around. And he'd go into these big refugee camps to bring their religion back, their Buddhism back to them, and he'd build these little bamboo temples, and he would show up, and he would just chant this ancient Buddhist chant from the time of the Buddha, and he would chant it over and over again. Hate is never overcome by hate. Hate is only overcome by love. And people would be joining the chant, and they would cry, because you know they'd lost their family, and Mahagosnanda himself lost his entire family in the genocide of Cambodia. And he would go there and chant this. Or Martin Luther King, who, you know, horrible things that he experienced and he witnessed. And he kept coming back and working for justice. And he said, you know, that he chose love because hate is too big of a burden. So when our heart breaks, it hurts. And one of the responses to hurt is to get angry and feel threatened. And that sometimes, some people takes the, when we're angry, then there can be hostility. Something has to change. Something has to be fixed. And to learn not to, again, this ability to stay still and be present and let our heart break and not be reactive to it is a very powerful thing. And one of the powerful things is that if we don't have our reactivity taking over, then it allows a chance for there to be wisdom, it allows a chance for there to be love, like a chance for us to see the situation better, see the other people better. And I hope that this practice that we do allows us to have those qualities, to have wisdom, to have love, and to be able to see other people with greater clarity. So that we all share this common, you know, the common family of humanity. So, and it's not so far away, these tragedies. Last Monday here, I gave a talk about Charleston, what happened there. And to my surprise, there was someone in Charleston who listened to that talk, and they sent an email. You know, say, I wanted to thank you, or, you know, what, you seem to be interested in this, and let me tell you what it's like here in Charleston this week. And mostly he talked about the love and the grace that followed the shootings. I mean, remarkable people, remarkable strength of character that came out there. And to me, that was one of the great bright lights of recent times, was the strength of character, the love, and the forgiveness that came out of that African-American church and demonstrated a remarkable thing to all of us. I think we can all learn from. And so yes, our hearts will be broken, and they'll be broken many times again. That's kind of the nature of this world. But then can we keep coming back to the light? So behind you.
Earlier this year, you gave a series of talks on the seven factors of awakening. And as I was listening to those, I was sort of feeling that I sort of understood what you meant and that I had experienced at least a little bit of those things, all except one. I don't think I've ever experienced anything like joy during meditation, mm-hmm. and it was as if I just didn't even understand what you were talking about.
Mm.
Am I doing it wrong, or am I? Maybe you can talk a little bit more about that. Thank you.
Yeah. So before I answer that question, I'd like to ask you, do you find meditation helpful?
Yes.
In what way for you?
I think it has given me insight into my own personality and my mind. It's calming, and sometimes I feel that it has helped me to avoid saying the wrong thing.
Mm. And do you appreciate all those benefits?
Yes.
Could there be, is appreciation and joy closely related?
Hmm.
maybe not the same thing, but could they be related?
I think I understand what you mean.
So what you might do is spend a little more time with the appreciation of what good you've gotten from it, and appreciate the goodness that's come from meditation, and maybe there's a nice way of kind of making more room for those benefits, and touch into those benefits more, and then probably there's some kind of joy will be there, but maybe it won't look like firecrackers joy, firework joy. Maybe it'll just be very quiet. Like a little subtle smile.
So folks have been talking about difficult emotions tonight, and you talked about being able to sit in kind of the seat of the watcher, I would call it. What in our practice supports that? I know concentration does, but can you talk a little more like what one can do to set the conditions for that?
To become, be more mindful, to watch or observe more clearly and without being caught in it. Well, I hope that this is not I hope this is a useful response. And that is, you have to really want to.
It is useful, Mike. Thank you.
And some people, I'm not saying for you, but for some people, if you found that it's not really happening, you find yourself pulled into the stuff over and over again, you can't really watch it, you might want to look at your motivation. And both, what are you motivated for? You know, because apparently you're motivated for something and you keep getting involved. And what is that? What are you motivated? What do you want? What's going on for you? So there's always this idea of looking at yourself, understanding yourself better. But if you want to be the watcher, you know, to have strong mindfulness and observe what's going on, maybe you need to kind of, you know, pump up a little bit more motivation. Really be clear on this. I want to do this. Sometimes in our mindfulness scene, there's a little bit too much kind of, and partly I'm responsible, right? For this, but a little bit too much that, you know, acceptance and just be present with things. Everything's okay, and just be with things. And it's okay teaching sometimes that way, but there's nothing wrong with having a strong, fiery motivation to be wake up and to be present and free. Behind you.
This is a little bit of a different question. I guess most of what's been talked about tonight is on an emotional level. And there's something I'm curious about discussing on an intellectual level. And there seems in Buddhism there's two different schools of thought on reincarnation. And there's the for and against. And I'm very interested in knowing, on having an open discussion, perhaps, on people's experience with their beliefs on that. And I'm in the school of where I believe in reincarnation, along with the Dalai Lama and a few others. Mm-hmm. And I've done a fairly good inquiry into the subject, I think, in a scientific and empirical way. And to me, the evidence is overwhelming of reincarnation.
Great.
But I could be wrong, too. So it's just, I'd just be interested in an open discussion about that.
Yeah, that's a huge topic, and I don't know if this is the time and place for an open discussion, all these people on that topic.
Yeah.
But I'm curious, as you asked that, it's a great topic. Yeah. Why do you want to have that discussion? Especially since you were pretty confident that you know, you've done the study and you're pretty clear, and you're in good company who believes it with you.
Yeah.
Why do you want the open discussion?
Oh, I just think it's very interesting. I'm very fascinated with different belief systems.
Ah.
And I'm just really interested in exploring different belief systems.
Mm, I see. So to hear the different range of what people believe.
Yeah.
There's a book by a wonderful Sri Lankan anthropologist, Obiasekara. And he wrote a book, studied rebirth and reincarnation theories, ideas, in different religions around the world. He studied certainly Indian belief system, Buddhist, and different Indian around rebirth, Native American, Greek, Egyptian, different things, to see all the commonalities and see how this works in different societies. And he wasn't coming down what is true or false, but he was just trying to understand the anthropology of it, how it worked. And it was called... I can maybe next week try to bring you the title.
But I'm really kind of interested in there's so many books have been written about near-death experiences, and a lot of people coming forth on radio talk shows and so forth about it. And most of them talk about former lives through this experience forth. And,
it definitely can be a big thing for people. I'm pretty amazed. I'm kind of like delighted or amazed and... I think it's a miracle that I wake up every morning.
Reborn each morning.
Wow. I get to do this another day. So I guess maybe if there is rebirth, maybe it's like that too. Wow. Another life. I get to be a teenager again. Wow. I don't know. Yeah. Thanks for bringing it up.
Okay.
So way out in the back, I see a hand going up. If someone can bring the mic out. All the way.
Good afternoon, everyone, or good evening. So I've never meditated ever in my life, but my friend invited me who meditates from time to time. And so I hear, I'm going back to the emotional place, and so I hear people talking about when they're meditating and they can identify negative emotions. And you talked about how to face them and sit with them. I recently have had some issues with someone close to me who loves me, I know, doing and saying certain things that they are doing out of love, and I don't embrace it as love.
Mm.
And so I'm wondering how meditation can help in recognizing love when... you don't see the action or the words as that, even though the person delivered it.
I see.
For you to interpret it that way.
So many times when people have love, it's often has a mixed message involved. So sometimes people react to the mixed message rather than the purity of a love. But let's just take it, at face value, if I may, that this was pure love. What I hear is from pure love was expressed towards you, and for some reason you couldn't be open to it. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Ah. Mm-hmm. Great. I mean, great. What's great? You see, as Buddhist teachers are strange people. It can be strange. What makes us happy is different than other people. So why I said great was appreciating that you recognize what was going on. That's what that recognition, that honesty, and enough to explain it, is a great beginning for this process of discovery. So what we do with the mindfulness practice is get curious and look at that more deeply. So look at what goes on for you when you're not open to that love. I don't know if you want to stay here, but do you have any sense of what's happening with you?
I can give you guys a small example. It's a very minor example, but it was something that I had to question, So I make breakfast for my partner almost every morning.
Uh-huh.
And lately, we've changed our diet, so we're doing high fat, and I've been cooking bacon. So in doing that, the bacon is, the grease is popping, the smell is getting in your clothes and in your hair, etc. And she says, don't cook in the clothes that you're going to wear for the day. And I'm just trying to do what I do. It's a routine. Yeah. I don't feel like changing my clothes. I don't want to be talked to about the clothes. But she was giving it to me out of love. Mm. But I received it as you're nagging.
I see.
You know, uh-huh. I don't know if that makes
yeah,
sense.
Yeah, yeah. So I don't know. But it sounds to me like you were busy, you're engaged, getting ready for the day. And so you had other things going on for you. You want to be finished and go on with your day, right? And to change your clothes, I mean, that takes a long time. And then change them back, you know, and, you know, it's just what a drag, you know, busy morning. Mm-hmm. And so it didn't really fit into the flow of your day. So one option is to realize it's a mixed thing going on for you. And if you recognize the mixedness, there's multiple layers going on, sometimes then it's possible to turn towards a person and say, I hear this as love. I hear that you're caring for me. Thank you. And it's actually hard for me to hear it right now. And I think I have to process this later. I have to think about this later. Or can we kind of not deal with this issue right now? Or this is too much for me at the moment, but thank you for your care.
Well, what's hard for me is that I see it as an issue rather than just recognizing it mm-hmm. for what it is.
And yeah, so why do you see it as an issue?
I don't know. That's the confusing part. And so I'm wondering, you know, if meditation can help me sort of channel. And I heard you mention something about reacting and how not reacting and taking a pause can right. help you to identify what it is that you're feeling so that you don't create a situation right. that, because that's what it does. It creates a situation because right. I'm then like, just leave me alone, you know?
Great. Yes.
But it's love, so.
Yes. So it's very common for people who meditate in the morning, have a morning meditation practice, that provides a certain level of calm and space that when they start their life, they're calmer, so things that come along, but people say, it doesn't impact them as strongly. They're not so quickly triggered by it. And there's like, oh, okay, I'll kind of more cool, it's okay. Or they're able to have more wisdom and see, or they understand why they're reacting, what's going on, or see the different options. And it's one of the reasons why a lot of people like to meditate every day is to gives them calm through the day or space in the day or kind of stability through the day too. How many people here find that the morning meditation practice does that for you? Are you the same people who raised your hands for the fear? So you see, and there's many more things I could say, but yes, just the calm and the steadiness of mind and the heightened attention that you have of what's going on can be a great support, especially it might last through breakfast. Wow.
Thank you.
Thank you. So we have time maybe for one more. See if you can bring the mic up here. And I see a hand here. Oh, okay.
Good evening.
You're on, yes.
It's back to emotions again. I'm brokenhearted.
You have to a little closer.
I'm brokenhearted.
Yes.
I'm a human being, and I'm brokenhearted, and this relationship is extremely significant. And over the last six, it's not a romantic relationship. Over the last 6 or 8 months, and I have some insight, and I have been meditating. I can't get off the train. Mm. You know, I continue to cling. Mm. I continue to try to force an issue and a relationship that. The other person is not ready to receive.
Right.
And even though I stand here and sit here mm-hmm. and meditate over it and see what I'm doing, I'm continuing to cling and I'm continuing to suffer.
Mm.
So I'm asking you, you know, what do I, you know, how do I stop clinging? How, you know, I know I'm suffering.
Yeah.
So I'm not just suffering and thinking, oh, you know, how could this be? I know that the clinging right. and not accepting what is in this relationship is causing incredible suffering for me, and I'm staying on the train.
Yeah, yeah, it's a common experience. These kinds of challenges, broken hearts around primary relationships is that one of the primary challenging, difficult things for a human being to deal with. It's not easy. And they're the kind of brokenhearted. So it's you're very human. So it's not like you're like, you know, weird because you have, this is what's happening. It's very common. But it can be worked with. And in fact, the deeper and more strong the reaction and the pain is, the suffering is around it, the more it represents something really important in your heart, in your inner life that needs tending to and needs care. And the greater the possibility of growth, the greater the possibility of freedom that can be found through it. So it might take a long time, might take a while to do it. Sometimes it's, if it goes on for so long, it doesn't work so well to do it alone. Sometimes it really helps to have people to talk to. Maybe not someone who's going to solve the problem, but somebody who can help be the witness for you. And so someone you can, like in therapy, for example, where someone, a therapist is not fixing you, but just listens non-judgmentally, makes space for it, and lets you kind of hear yourself and go through it and let it come out. It's very difficult sometimes when it's all in our own mind and our own hearts, that we're kind of repeating it over and over again. It's very hard sometimes to step out in a way. If you have someone who's a friend who can listen and just be a really good listener, as you say it out loud, it's a way of stepping away, and eventually you'll find that ability. You won't be so identified with it. That's one way. The other way is to begin appreciating the depth of the pain and to offer a lot of compassion to it. And there's a fair chance that you, even though you said so eloquently that you're suffering, I'd like to offer you a suggestion. I don't know you, so I don't know if it's true, but a suggestion is a little bit of a challenge. And that is, you might not yet know the depth of your suffering. And until you stop and are quiet, kind of contemplative time, quiet and feel and reflect and journal or do something, and try to feel your way to what is it in the depth of your being that needs your compassion. And you probably don't know what that is yet. And it probably has nothing to do with the relationship. And that's why sometimes we get stuck around relationships, because there's a deeper suffering that kind of the pain of the relationship is kind of confused with. And because we're confusing the two, we keep thinking it's a relationship. But there's really something deeper that needs your compassion and care. Is that, it's a big topic. Is that okay for now? Great, thank you. Well, thank you. It was nice for me to hear from you and hear what your concerns and interests are and to try to respond to them. I hope my responses were supportive, respectful, and to all of you. And I think that all the questions are probably relevant for many people who are here. So I hope those of you who didn't ask the question but heard yourself in the question, you could have asked that question. I hope that my responses were respectful for you and what you came here for today. So thank you all very much.